While the new year always gives us something to look forward to, we were saddened by the passing of a Napa Valley legend, Volker Eisler. Volker's focus and contributions to the future of the Valley are exceptional, and he will be missed. We consider it an honor to have spent some time at the winery talking with Volker back in 2011, and without a doubt, it's one we'll never forget. Our special thanks to Alex Eisler for setting the interview up. Our deepest sympathies to the Eisler family.
Yeah. You should have good ears.
Volker Eisler.
Volker.
Volker. That's right, you
yeah,
did
Volker
that.
Volker Eisler.
Volker Eisler.
Very good.
There we go. I'm getting there. Throw a shirt.
Volker Eisler.
And I'm here with you, here in, it's...
Childs Valley.
It is Childs Valley, okay.
In the Childs Valley District.
Which is right, which is an AVA in the Napa Valley area. So thank you very much for having us to your winery here. Tell me where you were born, where you came from, and how you ended up here.
I was born and raised in Germany, went to school there, and I got a scholarship to go to school in California. And I came to California in 1963, and went to graduate school at UC Berkeley, and where I met my wife. And then eventually we ended up here.
And what brought you up here? I mean...
Well, we had a little weekend house in Napa. So we knew the area, and we saw the development, the new development in the fledgling wine industry, and the newly awakened interest in food in this country. Mind you, Chez Panisse, the famous Chez Panisse, is after all in Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
At UC Berkeley, we invented Earth Day. I mean, all those things came together. People wanted to go back to the land. You were interested in agriculture. You were interested in natural things. And so we spent a lot of time here in our weekend place. And when the time came to decide where we would want to live more permanently, we thought about whether we could live in a more country-type situation. And then we decided to try ourselves whether we were equipped for country living. And we moved into our weekend house with our two small children. And we found we liked it. It was very agreeable. And I taught at the local college, which was not very agreeable, because I'm not a good teacher. I would have been a lawyer if I'd gone back to Germany. But in any case, then what other alternatives are there at that time in Napa County? None, except wine. Wine and vineyard. And with the help of our mothers, we purchased here this property in 1974. And to have been here ever since, and now our son, whom you have met, is in the business, and our daughter too. So we are right in the process of transitioning, and so both children will be actively engaged. So that's really, in a rough outline, the history.
Mm-hmm. What you decided to go into when you thought about grapes, it was strictly to start as a grower, is that right?
Yes, in the beginning, I really thought it would be sufficient to be a grower. And I liked the idea and so on. And it turned out I was, if I may say so, pretty good at it. But I found out also fairly quickly that in the long run, you cannot make a living as a grower. You cannot make money off the raw material. You need to have the final product. Whether you are in wheat or whether you are in grapes doesn't make any bit of difference. When you look at wheat, how much does the wheat farmer in Nebraska get compared to all the other people who are taking a piece of the action? And by the time the loaf is on the shelf and you pay an expensive price, out of that, 10 cents goes to the grower. So the question, I mean, it took a while, and my wife didn't want to go into the wine business. She didn't like the lifestyle so much. But eventually I convinced her, and then in 91 we started making commercial wine.
But before that, you were selling to all kinds of different...
Oh, lots and lots of different wineries, yeah. And on top of that, I managed vineyards for other people. I worked for a French company for several years, and I worked for other local people just to make money. And my wife is a landscape architect, so that's how she made money. Mm-hmm. And so we raised our children here, and generally speaking, didn't have to commute. I step out of my door, and here's my job.
Not a bad deal.
Well, that was one of the preconditions for the way we want to have our life. We did not want to commute. Mm. And just yesterday, I heard a story on TV news that people who have 45 minutes or more commutes, they have more frequent divorces, more frequent turmoils in the family, lots of problems, and health problems. Well, it doesn't surprise me when I hear this. I mean, anybody who has ever been stuck on the Bay Bridge knows the feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'll bring up your temper in a matter of seconds.
Yes, yeah, yes.
And the creative language you come up with.
Yes, yes.
Now, when you came up here, this was the property you had as your vacation house, or was...
No. Okay. That was 5 miles from here.
Okay.
No.
What part, where was that in the valley? I mean, just to get an idea.
5 miles from here.
Okay, I mean, what part? South, north?
Sage Canyon.
Oh, okay, Sage. Okay, good. Okay.
It's just to the south.
All right.
And we still have property there where our son is living now. And we knew this place. We had been here. Actually, we knew the people who owned it at the time. And so when it came on the market... And we had made the decision to move into the business. We were very excited because it was a very, at least outwardly, very romantic place.
I see what you mean by that.
But to be very truthful, we might not have had the courage if we had known how difficult it is.
But I thought winemaking was easy.
Yeah. Winemaking is very easy. Because all you need is yeast.
That's all there is to it.
And turns the juice into wine. There it is.
And Mother Nature grows the grapes. You don't have to do anything, right?
That's exactly right.
Right.
Mother Nature grows the grapes.
Right.
And there were some grapes here. Some were very, very old. But we knew when we came, we had to pull the whole vineyard that was here and redevelop the vineyard. And when it was all done and fine, or seemingly fine, we had phylloxera. And had to start all over again.
So that would have been in the late 70s, roughly?
No. Phylloxera came in the late 80s.
Okay, got my time wrong. So the amount of property you and I were talking, I'm going to repeat this question I already asked you. How much property do you have here and how much property do you
farm? We have 60 acres in vineyard currently, and we have over 400 acres total.
Okay, so 60 acres in vineyard. And just before this interview, we were walking through the vineyard, and we were talking about, you know, when you the suckering that's done, the dropping the fruit. So one of the questions, just for listeners to understand, especially when you're talking about 60 acres of fruit, how many times do you visit an average vine for this maintenance that you go through?
When you count pruning and tying, it's 2 trips. After that, you have at least 4 to 5 more. So you could have 7 trips every year.
And
to each vine. And when you have over 50,000 vines, you get an idea.
You can do the math from there, right?
Yeah.
And all of that is what goes into the price. Well, it's the start of what goes into the price.
Well,
of
the cost of farming goes into the price. And when I said earlier that the farming and it's not profitable enough, it's very easy. It's very easy to lose money on the farming end. But you make up for it by selling the final product. And when you sell grapes, 2 people have to live off the grapes. You, as the farmer, but also the person who buys the grapes from you has to make money off that. So that person is now eliminated. And if I break even on the farming, I'm doing very well. That's the key. And the farming is for us the key because we are banking on the geographic identity of this product here. And we don't buy grapes. We don't say these things, oh, we are sourcing the grapes for this wine from all the best vineyards. That's all baloney. The difference is really, when you look at scotch, between a blended scotch and single malt scotch. Single malt scotch is all the product we want, what we are interested in, what is interesting in terms of flavor differences and so on. It's the same with fine wine. It's the same with fine coffee. It's the same with fine tea. And lots of wineries have a habit of talking about their location, because it's the cooling evening breeze coming, and it's just perfect weather for various reasons. And then you find out 3/4 of the grapes they use are bought from other places. And this is sort of misleading. And it's maybe my European upbringing. For me, a vineyard has an identity, a clear identity. And the best wines in Napa Valley are wines from single vineyards. And you go to what I consider a good company, Phelps. Their best wine is a single vineyard wine, Bacchus. Might be overpriced, but that is not the issue. The issue is it's very good wine. Whereas their, what I call a designer wine, like Insignia, it's delicious, but it's designer wine. You know, you get grapes from different areas and so on. You do good marketing research and so on. But the single vineyard, that's where it's at. You go to Carneros, to my friends at Sainsbury, their best Pinot Noir is from a specific vineyard, the Brown Ranch. Excellent wine, you know. And that's where we want to be.
Which goes back to your point, as you were telling me before, that your fruit stays here. You don't sell any fruit. It goes into your own wine.
Right. That's we don't sell that. Fruit, and we don't buy fruit. On top of that, it's all organically grown since 1974. There are absolutely no chemicals here, no chemicals in the process of farming, and no chemical fertilizer.
Which makes a lot of sense, and of course that's where a lot of people are trying to go these days, which is good.
Yeah, but not nearly enough.
Yeah, right, right. It's a start.
It's a start.
Right.
Yeah. But mind you, I started that in 1974.
Which was a long time ago.
Yes, that was 37 years ago, and people thought I was crazy. And now it's in.
Yeah, well, isn't it how things come and go, right? Hopefully
right.
This will stay. I want to talk to you just about the building we're in. As we came in, you were telling me this was
built by the Zivas family from Germany. They were political refugees from Germany. And they built it in the late 60s. Of the 19th century. They built a house, they built a barn, they built shed, they built all kinds of things. And then they built this building for the winery. And as I described to you earlier, everything was hand-operated because there was no electricity. Electricity didn't come here until 1947. And they made wine here until 1920, until Prohibition shut them down.
Was anybody making wine before you came here, but after Prohibition?
No.
So this is just lay dormant, pretty much?
This lay dormant. This was like Snow White.
Yeah. Well, and I go back to the press that we looked at, which is just
outside.
Well,
it's been sitting there since 1880, but then nobody in its right mind would use a museum's piece for winemaking nowadays.
Right.
I mean, now there are beautiful presses from Germany, in France and Italy that do the job vastly better.
Mm-hmm. Am I correct in saying that you actually, the wine itself, the press you use, is that the Napa Wine Company? Is that where you do your...
We make the wine at Napa Wine Company. We have what is called an alternate proprietorship. That means we have our own federal bond in there, and we have our own space, and we completely control our production system, and we utilize their equipment and their crew, and then we have our own barrels in which we store the wine, and then eventually after the wine is bottled, the wine is moved to a temperature-controlled warehouse in St. Helena from where we can do consolidated shipping.
Mm-hmm. And then you do tasting up here in the mountain, and you also do tasting at the tasting room at the Napa Wine Company.
I don't do the tasting there, but they sell the wine legally because we have this alternate proprietorship. They're allowed to do that. I go there sometimes, help out, or they have parties or so. But you can purchase the wine there or here or in other venues.
I was interviewing Kendall Hoxsey the other day.
Oh, yes.
And she was a great interview. She took me around and was explaining all of it.
Right, right.
Places like that could be a mystery to some people who come here to the Valley. They don't quite understand this idea of so many labels
right.
in one space.
Right, right, right. But this is more and more because you look at the financial aspects setting up for a small winery. You can easily face a capital outlay of $2 million when you look at all the equipment, and then you use it just for a few days a year, and that doesn't make much sense.
No, I don't imagine. So I want to shift gears a bit to your history in Napa. I don't necessarily want to get into the politics or anything, but fair to say that you're the man who helped make Napa Valley an agricultural preserve.
No, this is really misstated.
Okay.
Because the Ag Preserve was a zoning ordinance that was created in 1968 by the Board of Supervisors. And that was only the beginning of many steps to the level of agricultural land protection we have now. And that very first step, I was there, I knew about it. My wife and I even wrote a letter to the Board of Supervisors, but I'm sure nobody read it. And I was not relevant. This would be incorrect to say this. However, afterwards, I think I've done a few things that have greatly contributed to this. And when you look back at the ordinance from 1968, you see the historical importance, but in and by itself, from looking from our vantage point now, it was nothing. It was very minor. The big difference was the county went from 1 acre minimum lot size to 20 acre minimum lot size with a lot of loopholes built in,
mm-hmm.
but only for the Napa Valley floor, nothing else.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, what did you think?
Well, I assumed it extended into the areas of the mountains and the outlying areas of the valley. That's not accurate.
No, it isn't accurate at all. It was just the main Napa Valley floor.
Hmm.
And already Stag's Leap area, a little bit to the east of the Silverado Trail, was question mark. All the realtors would have told you there's a 5 acre minimum. Now, in 1973, and you cannot deal with this stuff without politics, but we had a new board of supervisors, and there was one man who really drove the issues. They pushed through an ordinance that created a 40-acre minimum in all the hillsides. That was, in many ways, even more revolutionary than the ordinance in 68. But already in 76, the supervisors were afraid of their own shadow and reduced that 40-acre minimum to 20-acre minimum. And then in 79, they increased the minimum in the whole county to 40 acres on all the valley floors and all the hillsides. But the real change came with something very few people understand. In the state of California, we got a law back in 1972, I believe it was, or 73, that required that each jurisdiction, that means each city and county, had to have a general plan. Not only that, all the zoning in these jurisdictions had to correspond to the general plan. That means the general plan was all of a sudden the determining factor. Before that legislation, the general plans were fluff documents where people wrote in beautiful prose about the future of this town or this valley or so. Didn't mean anything legally. The only thing that was there was zoning. Now, all of a sudden, zoning was secondary to the general plan. It took a long time and a trillion lawsuits throughout California to show people how it really functioned. And we had in this county a planning director since 1971, Jim Hickey, who was really fabulous. That's the only word I can use. He developed in the general plan that was now legally required the what is called general plan designations on a general plan map. Each county now had a map where it was all designated, what is what, industrial or housing or whatever. And he came up with two designations for agricultural areas. One called agricultural resource. Those were all valley floors in the county. Wherever there was a valley floor, including Child's Valley, there was now AR, agricultural resource. And all the hillsides became AWOS, agriculture, watershed, open space. And that was brand new. Nobody had ever heard of anything like this. And those two designations comprise roughly 85% of the county. In 1980, we did something that helped us briefly. We passed an initiative that limited the population growth in the unincorporated areas to a maximum of 1% per year. And that was measured through census data and housing occupancy rates and so on. But that expired in 2000. Mm-hmm. But by 1990, I did play a role, big role. In 1990, I developed what later on became known as Measure J. And Measure J did the following. Think about these two designations I just described to you. If the supervisors, the county supervisors, wanted to change them to other uses, non-agricultural uses, they would first have to get a vote of the people. Mm-hmm. We passed that, 2-1. But we got immediately the biggest lawsuit. The county was sued. The county had to defend it. Mm. And the key, and this is why you can never do this without politics, I pushed through my candidate for the Board of Supervisors. So all of a sudden we had a 3-2 majority. And then the Board of Supervisors was ready to hire my attorneys who had developed this measure. It took 5 years of litigation until the California Supreme Court decided 5-2 that our Measure J was legal. And a lot of people tried to imitate us and failed. And for some strange reason in Ventura County in Southern California, they had some luck. And then by 2008, we realized that the 30 years for which the measure was passed, so 2020 wasn't that far away.
Not at all.
And so we figured we better renew it. And we saw two things demographically happening. One was the increase in the Hispanic population, voting population, and knowing that people who are relatively new to the process usually do not understand land use controls. They interpret this as an elite trying to keep out the riffraff, which isn't true, but that's the way it's interpreted. That was the one thing. The other thing is a lot of the older generation that had fought all these battles was dying, disappearing, moving, you know. So we had a new voting population, and we decided to renew it. And in 2008, we put it on the ballot under the name Measure P. And we added a few little things to that. And that passed and that is no more litigated. This is the law of the land. And this passed for 50 years. This is now valid until 2058. And I can tell you unequivocally, there's not a single county in the United States that has that level of agricultural land protection. We still have problems here.
Sure.
Lots of problems, and we don't need to go into those, but those are things. And one other thing we were able to do in between, in 1994, we increased the minimum lot size in the hillsides to 160. And that is now the 160 for the hillsides and the 40 acres for the valley floor are now also part of this Measure P. So if the supervisors wanted to change those numbers, they would have to get a vote of the people. And everybody knows that vote fails.
Oh, right, right.
You know, we once had a developer trying to persuade the supervisors to redesignate a big piece of land south of Napa, between Napa and the airport. And they wanted to build more houses than the city of St. Helena has. And they finally realized they had to put it on the ballot. The no vote was 82%.
Nice.
So they went home to Texas. The land was divided in 160-acre blocks and sold as vineyard. So it's now mostly vineyard.
What year would that have been?
That was in 1998. So it's not that long ago.
No, not at all.
But these issues don't disappear. There's an ever-increasing pressure for a simple reason. It's demographics. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to shovel snow in Milwaukee, right? She moved to San Francisco.
Yeah.
And you're probably looking for your proverbial 5 acres in Napa. But kidding aside, there are too many people who don't want to be in the cold weather.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And not only that, the lure of the valley, the atmosphere, the food, the wine, the nice weather, it's hard to beat.
Right.
Right. And it's close to San Francisco. You have 3 international airports within reach from here. I mean, it's fabulous, right? So, and that creates the pressure, relentless pressure. It's always a little chiseling on the edges. And you cannot devise a legal system that says absolute protection.
Right.
And when you see how preferably Republican administrations undermine national parks and other protected areas, supposedly for the good of the people. It's usually for the good of some companies, never good for the people, and not certainly not good for the land. Then you see what kind of pressure you can get.
Thank you for saying that. That's 100% true. You made the right decision at the right time. When you came here, it was almost perfection in terms of the history of the valley, in terms of the political history, and certainly in the terms of winemaking.
No, I have to tell you, the history is never perfect. And the challenges are always there. And to tell the story the way I just told it in a few seconds makes it sound easy.
Like making wine.
No. I mean, it's you have absolutely no idea how brutal these various fights have been in the last 40 years. And even the fight over the Ag Preserve, pitched neighbor against neighbor, brother against brother. I'm telling you, it's very, very, very tough. These things don't happen by themselves.
This is the end of part one of our interview with Volker Eisle. To download part two, visit lifebetweenthevines.com or go to iTunes.